This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Who are the world's happiest people? What's their secret to happiness? And what can we learn from their way of life that will make us happier? Three questions that are at the heart of my conversation in this next half hour with New York Times best-selling author Dan Buettner. Recently, the National Geographic Society sent Buettner to a handful of places around the world where people experience the highest levels of satisfaction and well-being. In his new book, Thrive, Buettner reports on the findings from the five-year global study. His quest, the keys to personal happiness. Dan Buettner lives in the Twin Cities. He joins us today by phone. Welcome back to The Exchange, Dan.
I'm delighted to be here again.
Listeners may remember that we had you on this program a couple of years ago about talking about your previous book, Blue Zones, a book about longevity. And in that book, you recounted how you led teams of researchers across the globe to uncover blue zones, the four geographic regions where small populations are living remarkably long, full lives. So, Dan, start off, please, by telling us, how did this book about happiness, zones of happiness, spring from your work on blue zones, longevity?
Well, it was a technique we developed at National Geographic. How do you explore big questions that human beings care about in a scientifically authentic way? So blue zones, we really made sure to find demographically confirmed areas that were geographically defined. Now, for happiness, it's a slightly different pursuit because you can look at a 100-year-old and check their ID and say, yep, they're 100 years old, but how do you do it with a happy person? How are you sure that that person's happy? So we ended up working with three huge databases, the World Database of Happiness, the World Value Survey, and Gallup, the World Poll. And they have aggregated tens of millions of surveys over the course of about 40 years, and we were actually able to find the happiest region of the happiest country on each of four continents. And then that's where we focused our efforts.
I want to reach out to our listeners before you do. Tell us about those four areas. To reach out to our listeners here in Iowa and across the Midwest, what aspects of your community make it a happy place to live? What aspects do you think could be improved on? And perhaps you've lived somewhere else, noticed that it was an especially happy or unhappy place. We'd like to have you tell us about it. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. So, Dan, spill it. Where are the happiest communities on the planet? Because we're all getting tickets. We're going to try to find jobs there. The entire population of Iowa perhaps moving to where?
All right. Well, the happiest place in Asia, this is going to shock you. Most people think Bhutan, where they have the gross national happiness, or Fiji, where they have beautiful sunny beaches. But actually, the happiest place in Asia is Singapore, the island nation of about 5 million people. Mm-hmm. The happiest place in Latin America is in and around Monterrey, Mexico, which is in the northeastern corner of Mexico. The happiest place in America is San Luis Obispo, middle of California, not exactly on the sea, inland a little bit. And the happiest place in the world, at least measured by how happy people say they are, is in far northern Denmark, the second biggest city of Aarhus.
Mm-hmm. And this is where you ran into, or you accompanied, I think, a trash collector, didn't you?
Yeah. So one of the things that Denmark taught us was that many of us think that the key to happiness or the path to happiness is through money or status or fame. And here's a place where the garbage man makes about as much as a lawyer. And they have this sort of Midwestern, you know, I'm from Minnesota, we essentially live on the same prairie, the sort of Midwestern attitude that kind of reminds us that you're no better than anybody else. Mm. And the sort of competition you see in New York or Los Angeles of people trying to one-up each other with newer fashions or newer cars, that you don't see that in Denmark. So what you have is a situation where people are free to get a job, or it's easier to get a job that addresses their interests instead of chasing after making more money, which we know you need some money, but you don't need as much as we think we do to be happy, and going after status.
Now in Denmark, I was surprised that you point out anyone making more than $70,000, the equivalent of $70,000, pays an eye-popping 60%. 60% in taxes. Now, we're in a country where the top bracket is 35%. How can 60% in taxes make a person happy?
Well, you have to realize you also have your health care taken care of. You can't be happy if you're not healthy. You have your education taken care of. when as you grow older, you don't have to worry about, will I have enough money to survive? So these things that bring us lots of dissatisfaction, ongoing, grinding, subtle dissatisfaction, are out of these people's lives. And as the great poet there put it, Nikolai Grunewald, he said, we're a nation where few have too much, but even fewer have too less, too little. So you have a place where people are largely status equal. Mm-hmm. And when you look at millions and millions of data points, it turns out what most highly correlates with happiness in nations is that status equality, not how high the GNP is necessarily.
And it's interesting you point out this. I think this is a study, a question in a study. You can tell me about it. You pose the question, which is the happier person? The person who earns $50,000 and lives in a neighborhood where everybody else pretty much earns about that much, or a person who earns twice that, $100,000, and lives in a neighborhood where others earn maybe $200,000 or more?
Yes, and in the neighborhood where the $50,000 person lives among other $50,000 year people, they're happier. And again, it's that subtle, I'm not quite good enough feeling you get when every time you step out of your house, there's a nicer car, nicer house, people have nicer fashions.
Right. And Singapore is a good example of this, too. A large middle class, not much of a gap between rich and poor. That was one of the places, even though it's very crowded, what, over 5 million people on this island nation.
Yes, and it's only 26 miles long. And they have 256 shopping malls. But this is a place that illustrates that evolutionarily we are more hardwired for security than we are freedom. Not free to buy pornography, you're not very free to start your own political party, but you can be a woman and walk any street any time of the night and be pretty certain nobody's going to accost you. Kids can play in playgrounds freely. It's also a place where just about everybody owns their own home. 90% of people own their own home. Mm-hmm. There are taxes in place that actually give you an incentive to keep your aging parent nearby. So the elderly, they're not necessarily paid money, but people are—they're more likely to get care just because of the way the tax system's set up.
And this is in some leads into some interesting points that you make, sort of broad points in the book. When it comes to perceiving happiness, some of the important factors seem to be cultural. And when it comes to East versus West, in very broad terms, Westerners see things much differently than the East, don't they?
We tend to be more individualistic and tend to put a huge value on individual accomplishment, whereas the people with a Confucian background, Asian, tend to put more value on collective, on marching along with their colleagues. So when it comes to happiness, you can't apply the same formula in all four of these places. There are a number of universals, and that's what really interested me. But there, you also have to recognize that depending where you are in the world, there's also a few culturally dictated differences. For example, if you put a Dane in Singapore and a Singaporean in Denmark, they wouldn't necessarily be happy, as happy.
As Garrison Keillor, I think, found out when he moved to Denmark for a short time. I don't know if you know about that. But
oh, yeah.
You are a Midwesterner as well, Dan Buettner. You live in the Twin Cities. And as you said, we share this prairie. So what can you tell us about the Midwest? Tell us about us prairie folk, how Iowa stacks up in terms of happiness compared to the rest of the country or the world.
Yeah, Iowa does pretty good. Iowa gets about a B in the United States. And the United States, compared to the rest of the world, gets about a B minus. But one thing I'll tell you, I know we're entering the dark, cold months of winter. Actually, weather does not have that big of impact on your overall happiness. If you live in a relatively sunny place, you're a tiny bit more likely to be happy. But mostly we adapt. We adapt to winters. One of the things, if you live on or near water, that'll give you a little happiness bump. I know there's not a lot of lakes compared to what we have in Minnesota, but that'll give you a little happiness bump. But we have the status equality. I think we can feel comfortable pursuing what interests us with not a lot of pressure to one-up our neighbors, and I think that's a big advantage. When it comes to worldwide correlations, trust is hugely important. And I think our values in the Midwest tend to make us trust each other more than you see in some of the other big cities across America. So I think we have the deck stacked in favor for happiness.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so we're thinking about our individual happiness, each of us here listening to this conversation. How much control do we have over our own happiness? What does the science say about this?
Yeah, and there's new emerging science. About 30% or 35% of our happiness is genetic. About 15% is chance. You know, if you live with chronic pain or you have a genetic depression, hard to be happy. But about 50% is up to us. And the argument I put forth in the book after spending 5 years at it is that the only real way to influence that 50% is to set up nudges and defaults in your life, 30 or so evidence-based nudges that will kind of change your surroundings in permanent or semi-permanent ways to make it more likely that you'll be happy.
Mm-hmm. So share with us some of your top nudges.
Okay. So income and financial security. Financial security has about 3 times the impact on your happiness than income just does. The newness of buying a new thing wears off in 9 to 14 months, whereas paying down your mortgage, buying insurance, putting money away for a rainy day, that kind of financial security can give you decades or a lifetime. Much better investment when it comes to happiness. Proactively, who we hang out with, it turns out, has a massive impact on how happy or unhappy we feel. It even impacts our loneliness. If you hang out with lonely people, you're more likely to feel lonely.
So what do you do if you find yourself right now and say, you think about it, hey, I hang out with people who make me feel blue, who are lonely. Do you abandon those people or do you try to change the relationship?
Yeah, I wouldn't tell you to dump your old friends. They may need you. But I would tell you to take some of your free time and invest it in augmenting your social circle and look especially for happy person. Every new happy person you add to your personal network increases your own happiness by about 10% or your own likelihood to be happy by about 10%. And friends tend to be long-term adventures. I'm not a big fan of this pop psychology or motivational courses, even though they may provide some short-term happiness, it tends to dissipate in a very short period.
Mm-hmm. Talk about happiness in the workplace. How can we improve that if we don't have it at an optimum right now?
So HealthWays and Gallup have interviewed a million Americans to date, and the number one correlation between happiness in the workplace and other factors is, do you have a best friend working there? So if you're working in a place where you don't know any of your coworkers, making that effort to make a best friend, very important. When it comes to vacations, we get more satisfaction from taking lots of small vacations than we do taking one big vacation, because research shows the lasting impact of vacation comes largely from anticipating that vacation and remembering, as opposed to actually experiencing it.
Mm-hmm. That probably matches up with what the boss wants, too. He probably likes shorter vacations.
Yeah, I don't want you gone for a long time.
We don't want the work to pile up too much on your desk while you're away. Okay, what else at the workplace? Anything else?
Yeah, well,
You talk about commuting. It's great to have a job close. A long commute gets rid of happiness.
So if you make about $50,000 a year and you can walk to work, it would take a $40,000 raise to make a 2-hour commute equate to the same level of happiness as you have now. In other words, commuting for Americans is the thing we dependably hate the most on a day-to-day basis. So the more you can take a commute out of your daily life, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Work is so profoundly important. Most of us spend most of our waking hours at work, and to make sure we're getting a job that challenges us, that engages our talents, and that every once in a while a couple hours can just melt away and we don't even remember. That's so much more important than trying to go after money. When it comes to America, after we earn about $75,000 a year, the experienced impact on money completely disappears. So
once you've reached $70,000, there's no more, relatively speaking, no more happiness to be found above that.
Yeah, there's 2 types of happiness. There's our remembered happiness or our evaluative happiness. The problem with that is we only remember about 3% of our past and the highs and lows. That kind of happiness keeps going up. So millionaire will tell you, yeah, I'm a lot happier than that guy making 100 grand a year. But if you look at his life, if you look at his experience happiness, he'll spend much of his day more likely to be in a high-pressure job, worried about his portfolio. He may have a or she may have a spouse that is more demanding. Kids need to be driven to private schools. So what we should be shooting for is about $75,000 a year. And once you make that amount, when it comes to your work life, you should be backing off on the hours. 37 hours a week seems to be ideal, at least looking at the Denmark model. Taking all of your vacations and then spending some of your time volunteering. And this has been replicated in dozens of studies around the world. Volunteering is almost a sure way to stack the deck in favor of happiness.
Dan Buettner with us for this half hour. His new book is called Thrive, talking about how to set your life up for increased chances of happiness. The final minutes with you, Dan, I wanted you to address this because you mentioned governments and so forth. What can you say about governments and happiness? Which types of governments tend to foster happiness? You looked at a variety of them in this book.
Yes. So it's not governments that typically we've been measuring happiness with GDP, trying to maximize GDP or GNP. The higher that is, it seems the happier. But that's not it's not actually the best measurement. Tolerance is hugely important. Can I be black, white, gay, female, old, whatever, and feel like I fit in? Mm-hmm. Trust. There's a very clear inverse correlation between corrupt governments and unhappy places, even if they're in beautiful sunshine. As I mentioned before, status equality. That's not quite as important as income equality, but a place where everybody feels like they're kind of on the same footing.
When you look at our politics, say, today, what changes in policies being discussed in Washington reflect a move towards more happiness or away from happiness in our society?
Well, you can't be happy if you're not healthy, and worrying about health grates away at our happiness. So the policies in place that will make Americans healthier are good ones when it comes to happiness. Anything that favors the old, I think the security of older people, very clear correlation. The more that's spent on the older people, the happier the society seems to be, and we see that both in Singapore and Denmark. They rank tops. Mm-hmm. And then policies that encourage people to socialize. The happiest Americans report about 7 hours of social interaction a day. So any policy that favors parks, favors wide sidewalks, favors people getting out and interacting. And also there's a correlation between consumption of the arts and happiness. So those are also good ways for our government to spend money.
What role does religion play in happiness?
Worldwide, religious people are happier than non-religious people. But what's not clear is if you're an atheist, if you can make yourself go, you know, start becoming a Catholic or whatever. But it probably makes sense to, if you had a faith when you grew up, to go back and try to reconnect or look for another one.
Have you done any look at the study of happiness and how it's changed throughout history? Because this is fairly recent that we're having this big scientific focus on happiness, isn't it?
Yes, it's about 20 years the field of positive psychology has emerged. And that's really when these investments have been made in these huge worldwide surveys. And places like France and Canada and Great Britain are starting to create happiness indices, valid ones that will shape policy. And I think it's a brilliant thing because at the end of the day, the job of our politicians is not to just make our country richer. It's to make our country happier. And they require pulling different levers.
Do you find people, though, still, I'm sure, with this young science, area of social science, who poo-poo the study of happiness as unscientific, esoteric, and unimportant?
Well, the leader in this field is a psychologist named Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel Prize. And I think it's really hard to poo-poo gathering data and looking at correlations. That said, you have to realize that this is a game of deck stacking. You can stack the deck in favor of happiness of an individual or even more so a nation, but it doesn't assure it. And there are trade-offs in every case.
Mm-hmm. So as we close this hour, what is the best single piece of advice you can give each of us today that we could do today and create a habit, if we don't already have it as a habit, to increase our happiness and those around us?
I'll give you a couple small things very quickly. Number one, you should sleep at least 7.5 hours a night. if you're sleeping only six, you're probably only 30% as happy as if you're losing about 30% of your happiness. You should eat a plant-based breakfast. You'll have more energy all day long. And when it comes to working out, just 20 minutes of exercise boosts your well-being by for about 12 hours. So you should do your exercise before noon. Mm-hmm. Those three things will increase your happiness by about 40%.
Has this study of happiness around the world changed the way you live your life?
I've always been a really happy person, but now I even socialize more than I used to because I have the justification that I should be doing it 7 hours a day.
It makes sense to the left brain or whatever part of the brain we use, right?
Yes. I quit working at 5 and enjoy the rest of my day.
Dan Buettner, it's been a thrill to have you on the program again. Thank you very much. Thrive is the title of Dan Buettner's latest book, the New York Times best-selling author, Finding Happiness the Blue Zone's Way. Dan? Have a happy day. Rest of your day.
I had a blast. All right. Great to talk to you.
Take care. Dan Buettner with us. And on a related topic, Monday on this program, we'll follow up with Des Moines explorer and adventurer Charlie Whitmack. Talk about someone who leads a happy life doing what he loves to do, exploring, having adventure. His 11-month journey is an unprecedented 10,000-mile triathlon from England to the summit of Mount Everest. He's completed now two legs of that mammoth triathlon. Recently, Whitmack rode his bicycle over a more than 12,000-foot mountain range on the border between Kyrgyzstan and China. We will talk also about his efforts to reduce maternal mortality in Nepal when we discuss this with adventurer, explorer Charlie Whitmack Monday on this program. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Jeff Schmidt. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt, and our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight, but this is something else, something to do with happiness, no doubt. To leave us, The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Every day.